15. Mud Drag, Part 2. I had been called back to answer a subpoena. In total, I received 6 subpoenas, all of which compelled me to testify truthfully via videotape before a grand jury. I was questioned in a small, simple room containing a few chairs and a single table. Nothing was ornate. It resembled a nicer version of a standard interrogation room. With the videographer's setup, plus the court reporter, her little machine, and the prosecution lawyers crowding inside, the room got even smaller. All eyes, especially the dark eye of the video camera, were on me. All I had for comfort was my conscience and a plastic bottle of water. The court reporter swore me in. Secret Service attorneys stood outside, waiting for me to excuse myself and come to them when I had questions regarding what I had to keep secret. "Do the right thing, Gary," I felt my wife was saying miles away. A female attorney from Starr's staff counseled me on my right against self-incrimination. She reminded me that I couldn't lie by saying I don't remember. She reminded me that her team wouldn't ask about secret or privileged matters of the White House. But they definitely wanted non-privileged information. The gray areas between privileged and non-privileged was my not-so-private hell. C-SPAN later broadcast the video of my interrogation, but viewers didn't get the whole picture. The Secret Service blacked out details regarding my postings, official names, and details or accounts of the president's movements. I could finally provide those after Chief Justice William Rehnquist essentially voided the concept of protective privilege. Then all the marking, noting, and initialing of exhibits started, just to keep things straight. My plastic water bottle was my crinkly comfort blanket. I really wanted to feel the reassurance of my firearm against my hip, but that was not to be. They made me hand over my gun before my questioning commenced. They wanted to know every little detail. I testified to the numerous times I had discovered Monica where she clearly didn't belong, what I thought of her, how she manipulated friendships, how distraught Nell was, and how I'd thrown away those lipstick-smeared towels. I couldn't legally mention semen, because that was the president's. I wanted to curl up and die. I made it clear that I never thought I was committing any crimes. I thought I was protecting the president from more rumors, particularly the true ones. They asked if I connected the lipstick to Monica. Surprisingly, no one had ever asked me that before, so I never revealed my thoughts. But presidential protective function privilege prevented my honest answer. I was on thin ice any which way I moved. "You thought it could be anyone?" a lawyer asked. I responded with a heavy fear upon my chest. Without revealing any privileged information on the advice of my counsel, yes, I did. I wasn't lying. Or was I? I was up a legal shit's creek without a paddle. The only one who could un-F my situation was the president. I did not connect the lipstick to Monica at that time. "At all?" he said, surprised. "No." "Did you connect the lipstick to anyone?" Without revealing any privileged information on the advice of my counsel, I paused before saying, "Yes, I did." "You connected it with someone, but didn't connect it with Monica?" he said with some surprise, his voice betraying eager anticipation of what I might say. "Yes," I answered. "Did you connect it with a woman?" "Yes." "Can you tell me whether it is a White House employee?" "It is." It wasn't past tense. She still worked there. "Well, I'll just ask the straightforward question. Who did you connect it with?" "I connected it with," the service blacked out her name. She was the West Wing receptionist at the time. "What made you connect it with," blacked out her name. Without revealing any privileged information, and I trailed off. I tried insinuating that there were other women, what a womanizer and an unabashed cheater the president was, and how crazy things really were at the White House. But that was risky. I had no attorney-client privileges to save me from my own bosses. The Justice Department swore they would never release these tapes to the public, but who trusted them? They asked me about the towel incident and if Monica was an employee, a blue pass holder at the time. I told them the truth. Yes. She had been an intern mistress who was fired. She returned as an employee mistress, despite the intention of many others, including myself. I told them about the West Wing receptionist and how I believed, for reasons that I couldn't reveal, that it was her lipstick. The woman had been a flight attendant turned organizer, with her husband, of private flights for people like rock stars, or in this case, for a presidential candidate. ABC News broadcast video of 1992 presidential candidate Clinton with his hand between this future receptionist's leg on one of those flights. Another flight attendant from that series of charter flights later accused President Clinton of sexual harassment and tried peddling that story. Hailing from Texas, the receptionist had that special Lone Star twang and flair. Actually, she was very charming and a good person. I did not want to reveal her name. But neither she nor I fell under the presidential protective function privilege. When she became a White House receptionist, she worked closely with Hernreich and Curry. She'd even fill in for them if they stepped out of their offices. I never doubted her character because I never knew how the First Lady factored into it. The rumors were that Mrs. Clinton sanctioned everything like a grand puppet master, so I never had a problem with that receptionist. I did have problems with Monica, who manipulated us into allowing her into unauthorized areas, ultimately to get to the president. I knew about that receptionist. I even once witnessed her giving the president what looked like a back massage, about Eleanor and about Monica. Discussing Clinton's behavior, however tangentially, during my deposition made 1600 Pennsylvania seem more like a late-night red-light district than a national institution. I never discussed such matters with any co-workers outside of work. The information we shared was always a whispered heads-up, a professional courtesy, but not gossip. I felt like I was gossiping here. In the deposition videotape, you can see me slump farther into my chair, not exactly my proudest moment. I felt trapped. I couldn't reveal what I knew about the semen. I couldn't say a word. It was the most privileged of information. I corroborated what I, among many others, had heard of how an officer or a staff person had walked in on Eleanor and the president in the White House movie theater. I also corroborated how Monica had tried to gain entrance to the White House during a congressional visit by befriending some other higher-up. She had her ways. An officer she had once befriended was used to her being off-book, not officially logged in as per protocol, when he screened her, and he escorted her through to the White House. Another officer barked at him, "Either you walk her off the grounds and back to the gold rope section immediately, or I will." I also testified regarding an incident that occurred during the 1996 Christmas season, a black tie Who's Who event. We were clearing guests in tuxedos and ball gowns when I saw Monica. I stormed over to her, saying indignantly, "You know you're not supposed to be here." But when I checked the list, sure as shit, there she was, as a guest of an invited guest. How strange was that? Minutes later, a social office higher-up approached my sergeant and me as we screened more visitors. She barked, "You guys screwed up. You let Monica in." I just laughed. She stomped off. I got my buddy Henry to cover my post for a second while the sergeant and I chased another social office employee, whom I'll call Kim. Kim was with her assistant and was also fuming about how you guys screwed up by letting in Monica. Kim pointed at me specifically, getting a tad too personal. I knew I couldn't let Kim get away with that. At this point in the deposition, the Secret Service blacked out a huge chunk of my testimony. I still can't discuss it. Honest. Back to the action. I interrupted Kim. "Is this Monica's name on the list?" I asked her like a smartass. I couldn't help my bitter undertone. I pointed to Monica Lewinsky on the guest list. Flipping to the first page, I pointed to something else. "Is that your signature? Then you let her in, not us. You signed off on it, not us. That was your job." Ironically, the social office was under the First Lady. Technically, it was FLOTUS's job to extend the invitations, But the idea that Mrs. Clinton would take responsibility for someone under her command? Laughable. I surely never saw it. At this point in the deposition, I realized I had roped myself into a bit of a snare. The investigators start asking why Kim would be angry that Monica made it into the White House, and why everyone from the social office to the UD knew that Monica was unofficially blacklisted. If it wasn't official, yet everyone knew, what did they know? What were the terms by which people, including Kim and I, knew why Monica was transferred and blacklisted? They kept asking. I told them how Kim knew that Monica had been transferred to the Pentagon even after being a pass holder, an employee. I couldn't really say what we knew. Why would Kim be so adamant that you guys had screwed up? Asked the one lawyer. Well, she would blame anything on us, to be honest with you, I responded. I explained to them how Kim and others from the social office disdained us, which was absolutely truthful. I didn't dare explain the reason for their animosity. Their boss, Mrs. Clinton, hated us. The previous administration's social office had been very kind and professional to us, even if they suspected that we had screwed up. I ducked the lawyer's queries about Monica's exile because I couldn't give him the real answer, that the president had dropped her like a bad habit, which, come to think of it, she was. I did relate a story of how the president one night had directly ordered a sergeant to rush the control center to expedite Monica's screening so she could meet him for a completely off-the-books late-night session. He had never before called the CQ to expedite screenings for anyone. I explained to the lawyers, whenever I had heard about any of these rumors, I tried to get the hell out of the room. I was just so fed up with the rumors. With the things at the White House, I was tired, so aggravated, that I had to just get the hell out of there. And I still do. The manpower costs involved in this investigation were massive. I was paid for weeks to do nothing more than answer or not answer questions. The Justice Department allocated all its legal heavyweights to the fray. The service lost dozens of men for days on end to the legal battle of protecting the president. Who could tally the cost of all the men and women who felt compelled to leave their jobs, or those like Linda Tripp, who were compelled to work against their boss, the president? Morale descended to an all-time low. The president could have let all these resources return to their normal jobs with a few simple words. But they possessed too great a store of Machiavellian pride for that. The New York Times published a drawing that was spot on, albeit demoralizing. It nailed the issue of our credibility. It portrayed three cartoon Secret Service agents with their aviator glasses and earpieces. They separately gestured, "Hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil," but the sightless agent had slightly lifted his dark glasses. He was peeking. He saw the evil. While I wasn't an agent, I knew I was among this trio. I wasn't happy about being in the New York Times, although with each subpoena, I did request legal counsel to mail me more presentable copies. I wanted something to frame on my wall when everything was said and done. They laughed in disbelief. My final testimony concerned Monica's arrival at the Northwest Gate on her way to meet with Betty Curry. I revealed Betty's name, but once again, not the president's. I related how gate officers phoned Betty to confirm Monica's appointment and how Betty ordered them to delay her since the president was busy. I testified that Monica called the Oval Office via a checkpoint payphone. She couldn't have used the president's secret military line, as I testified she had inside the White House. If only Nancy Hernreich, the director of Oval Office operations, had put Monica on the E6 access list, that granted the first daughter, lady, or chief of staff anytime access, as other E6 UD and I had futilely asked, but there were so many what-ifs. With Monica giving the president an earful and the president fuming to Betty, Betty called me to see how we could sort out the issue of a UD gate officer leaking whom the president was with and what he was doing. What the president didn't know, and I didn't mention it because nobody asked, was that the gate officer told Monica that the president was with another piece of A, and that she would have to wait her turn. With his cats out of the bag, the president was incensed. An attorney halted the proceedings. I'm going to ask you to stop at this point and maybe ask you to step outside. Have you discussed this incident with your attorneys? Yep, I said quickly. You have? Have they discussed privileges with you? She inquired unemotionally. Yes, and that's probably as far as I can go. Yeah, so that's what they decided I could talk about. We all started to begin every sentence by saying, without revealing any privileged information, I testified that the incident had traveled up the chain of command to the sergeant and the watch commander. I informed them that even in discussing the incident among ourselves within UD, we remained circumspect. An attorney asked why. The real answer, which I also couldn't say, was to save ourselves from being dragged through the mud like this. The less you knew, the safer you were. Not to mention, we simply feared the Clintons. They asked me to disclose the name of the officer who told me the story of Monica at the Northwest Gate. They wanted me to corroborate, and I hated those attorneys for it. I told them that we officers recognized we had made a mistake even discussing it, but I had put the snare on myself. We had discussed the story because we were tired, wound up, overworked, and frustrated at the corruption and the bullshit. We hated hanging tight and wading through the new culture that consumed the White House. We knew not to talk about that stuff because it could implicate us in a legal fray. I was compelled to tell the truth, but why the hell was neither the president nor Mrs. Clinton ever really compelled to tell the damn truth? We had to get dragged through their mud for this. I didn't want to put another officer in the hot seat. Who was this? Asked the attorney. Is it important? Do you need to know? I'd hate to disclose his name and... I mean, is it that important to you? I asked. I pleaded. He snapped back at me, unequivocally. Yes. I know for a fact you've already talked to him about it. I know we made a mistake, and I prompted this onto him. We made a mistake. I do realize it's clear that you did need to know this, but... I told him who it was. My fellow officer would be dragged back into their damn office to be cross-examined yet again over the excruciatingly fine details. I was pissed at myself. It was all because of Monica. No, it was all because of Bill and Mrs. Clinton and the way they governed. They asked me another question. I told them I needed to step outside. Out in the corridor, I got my head straight. I returned, and they asked me a few more questions, and I invoked privilege. Their attorney feared that they had pressed me too far and worried that I'd now stonewall behind privilege and foggy memory. We took another break. Many a time in my preceding interviews, I'd asked, "The director of the Secret Service isn't going to see this, right?" Or, "You guys aren't going to release this deposition to the public, are you?" I was being asked to provide very sensitive information pertinent to some higher-up's careers. Some officers even had to divulge affairs not related to the president, snaring them into disclosing which directors or chiefs were having affairs with which staffers. It was all very bad. The stories got leaked to the press, and things got ugly for them. Again, lawyers conducting my depositions reassured me they wouldn't release my testimony, as the other lawyers did to other witnesses. It's what they told us all, those Justice Department and FBI bastards. Not long after my video deposition, I was talking to a Secret Service colleague who worked the West Wing lobby. He had just resumed his shift after returning from his own testimony. The president had just visited him. That was extremely suspicious. My associate was spooked. He just came out and came straight up to me like he was looking for me. Yeah, and he asked how I was by name. We chatted, like small talk, like normal. And then he asked how my wife and kids were. We've never actually talked before. Nothing about that was normal. It was obviously a subtle form of intimidation. The president was sending a message that he knew of the officer's recent testimony, and perhaps was sending an even more sinister message. I certainly was glad to be at JJRTC, away from them. It was all so wild, so bizarre. Prior to that, the president didn't seem to know my fellow officer by name. Someone, most likely the president's attorney, advised him to make small talk immediately after the officer testified. The president's little hint spooked both of us. It confirmed to me what I suspected. That was indeed how they operated. It was reminiscent of the stories we had heard of some of the women who alleged that the president, while governor, had either raped or sexually assaulted them. In one of the stories, Mrs. Clinton had homed in on the alleged victim, despite having never met her beforehand, just as the president zeroed in on the West Wing lobby officer. I was glad to be at JJRTC, but I feared that I was not far enough away. Our Secret Service attorneys reassured us that our video depositions were supposed to be in lieu of actual in-person testimony. But that was never Starr's intention, and 2 weeks later, Starr summoned us back to the courtroom for us to testify in person. It was insurmountably stressful. I remember the feeling of being trapped or drowning. I, along with my fellow Secret Service staff, was still caught in the legal tug of war between the Treasury Department Secret Service, who claimed protective privilege, and Ken Starr, who said that was pure hogwash. Not surprisingly, neither side would budge, and the issue went to court. In May 1998, Judge Norma Holloway Johnson, a Jimmy Carter appointee, sided with Starr, who said that USSS agents and UD officers could testify. The Treasury Department Secret Service appealed. In early July 1998, a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit unanimously sustained that opinion. The Treasury Department Secret Service appealed again, this time all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. Now, it was getting interesting, particularly for me. Starr had already scheduled my appearance before the Whitewater Grand Jury. But what was I free to say in front of it? Should I obey my bosses, who wanted everything hushed up, or the appeals court, who wanted me to talk? If I listened to the appeals court and the Supreme Court ultimately ruled against it, I'd really be hung out to dry. Mark advised me to obey the law, tell the truth, and definitely not to fall on my sword for either Bill's or Monica's misdeeds. Just as in the old Gary Cooper movie, the shootout would occur at high noon. Or at least, that was the deadline on July 18, 1998, by which the U.S. Supreme Court had to decide whether to take up the Treasury Department's appeal or to let the Federal Appeals Court ruling stand and allow me to testify. The clock ticked. Just 4 minutes before noon, word arrived from the Supreme Court. Chief Justice William Rehnquist had ruled. The Supreme Court would not grant the Justice Department's appeal. The D.C. Appeals Court ruling held. The presidential protective function privilege was bogus. I could testify. But to whom? The normal audience before whom I would testify, Starr's Whitewater Grand Jury, had been excused for a few days. I was sitting in the federal courthouse. They weren't. Starr grabbed another grand jury, completely unrelated to that one, from down the hall. I would testify before them. The games would begin. Another atmosphere of high drama, near panic, filled the room. It certainly consumed me. I was a wreck. In the past 2 weeks, I'd gotten only 3 hours sleep. 3 hours. I would run for 7 miles a day trying to exhaust myself into some sleep. It never worked. I never slept. I wanted to throw up. Reaching for a wastebasket to heave in, I struggled not to barf on a U.S. Marshal. They hustled me out of the grand jury room. I made it to the men's room just in time. My grand jury testimony warred against everything that I believed in, and even against myself. No matter what I did, I could not escape a dreadful feeling of betraying someone or something. My fellow servicemen, my protectees, the protectee, and even my previous testimony. I've all but blacked it out of my mind, except for the horrible feeling of dread. We servicemen completed our highly constrained testimony and waited for the other dominoes to fall. Following a week of legal debriefing and further BS, I returned to my post at JJRTC's security unit. It was time to work on my career goal of becoming an instructor. I kept checking in with my supervisor on my application to become an instructor. I wanted to teach others how to protect innocent lives and to halt bad guys. When an instructor spot opened, however, I was repeatedly denied an opportunity even to test for it. I finally pressed my supervisor. Initially, she had trouble looking me in the eye. Then she sighed, folded her arms, and looked me straight in the eye. "Gary, I keep sending up the paperwork, but honestly, higher up the chain, your name is Mud. They all know who you are." I wanted to scream. Long story short, I decided to short-circuit the chain of command by approaching someone I knew could help. He was as outraged as I was. "I'm not asking that you give me the position," I told him. "Just give me the same chance as everyone else. Let me take the tests." He agreed, and against the wishes of the higher-ups who had blackballed me, I was allowed to test. Meanwhile, the STAR investigation played out sordidly. Only half its drama, my part, transpired behind closed doors. The rest unraveled in full public view. The Clintons kept burrowing. STAR kept digging after them, the way a dog digs a fox from its den. But I was ready to put the events of my Oval Office posting behind me and launch a new life of teaching men and women of character, bright apples picked right off the tree, how to defend not only their lives, but the lives of others. I had a wonderful wife and a healthy newborn baby girl. She was the great gift of our lives, a little ball of joy. We had survived the Clintons' hell and achieved something so victorious and so grand, our little firstborn, our baby girl. I so much wanted to get on with the rest of the American dream. On Monday afternoon, August 17, 1998, while still at the White House, President Bill Clinton became the first president to appear before a grand jury and testify regarding his own actions. It was videotaped just the way ours was, but he also appeared live, though remotely, to that grand jury via closed-circuit TV. Now he was cornered and finally had to pay the piper, or at least tell some portion of the truth. We all held our breath. That night, he spoke via television to the entire nation, furiously trying to stay ahead of the shitstorm he himself had created, when on Saturday, January 27, he made a demonstratively false sworn statement, outright perjury, that the allegations about him and Monica Lewinsky were false. He said emphatically and fervently, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky." It was his word against ours, with a titillated world watching. Only because of Linda Tripp, Monica Lewinsky's infamous blue dress, and Ken Starr could the truth set us all free. Jenny and I watched the president's four-minute performance as if it were a made-for-TV movie, albeit begrudgingly. It took our beautiful baby girls hooting and hollering to break our stunned silence. That morning, the president had presented his version of events to the STAR grand jury. We had stared at our TV as the president had commenced. He blinked twice. Someone behind the camera had delayed a few seconds too long to give him the wave, signaling that they were on air. It was a long, awkward, nail-biting 2 seconds. "Good evening," he began. "This afternoon, in this room, from this chair, I testified before the Office of Independent Counsel and the grand jury. I answered their questions truthfully, including questions about my private life, questions no American citizen would ever want to answer. Still, I must take complete responsibility for all my actions, both public and private. And that is why I am speaking to you tonight. As you know, in a deposition in January, I was asked questions about my relationship with Monica Lewinsky. While my answers were legally accurate, I did not volunteer information. Indeed, I did have a relationship with Miss Lewinsky that was not appropriate. In fact, it was wrong. It constituted a critical lapse in judgment and a personal failure on my part, for which I am solely and completely responsible. But I told the grand jury today, and I say to you now, that at no time did I ask anyone to lie, to hide or destroy evidence, or to take any other unlawful action. I know that my public comments and my silence about this matter gave a false impression. I misled people, including even my wife. I deeply regret that. I can only tell you I was motivated by many factors. First, by a desire to protect myself from the embarrassment of my own conduct. I was also very concerned about protecting my family. The camera slowly zoomed in. I wondered why. Was the president poised to say something dramatic? Nope. Just more bull. The fact that these questions were being asked in a politically inspired lawsuit, which has since been dismissed, was a consideration too. To which lawsuit was he referring? Whitewater? Paula Jones? Dismissed? His misconduct never was. He was deflecting from the real issue, his character and his lies. He continued. In addition, I had real and serious concerns about an independent counsel investigation that began with private business dealings 20 years ago, dealings, I might add, about which an independent federal agency found no evidence of any wrongdoing by me or my wife over 2 years ago. The independent counsel investigation moved on to my staff and friends, then into my private life. And now the investigation itself is under investigation. This has gone on too long, cost too much, and hurt too many innocent people. Now, this matter is between me, the two people I love most, my wife and our daughter, and our God. I must put it right, and I am prepared to do whatever it takes to do so. Nothing is more important to me personally. But it is private, and I intend to reclaim my family life for my family. It's nobody's business but ours. Even presidents have private lives. It is time to stop the pursuit of personal destruction and the prying into private lives and get on with our national life. Our country has been distracted by this matter for too long, and I take my responsibility for my part in all of this. That is all I can do. It is past time to move on. We have important work to do, real opportunities to seize, real problems to solve, real security matters to face. And so tonight, I ask you to turn away from the spectacle of the past 7 months, to repair the fabric of our national discourse, and to return our attention to all the challenges and all the promise of the next American century. Thank you for watching, and good night. My heart started to climb down to a normal beat. I rubbed my eyes and patted Homer. My wife turned to me and I to her. I so hoped we could now move on. I didn't want to see Secret Service Guard Gary Byrne in the newspaper anymore. That was for damn sure. We cleaned up the kitchen and made ready to start the day early tomorrow. I considered going out for another run to cool my nerves. We didn't know what he had said in the testimony, but later, as I lay in bed trying to translate the president's highly crafted words, I realized a few things. And I was pissed. As I listened to his cunning, scripted message, I became even angrier. He never apologized to us. He never apologized for putting us in that position. He lied out of both ends of his mouth, blaming the Secret Service while saying he wanted to be forthcoming but couldn't. Two lies in one. He and his staff created the protective function privilege. He was the one who did the deed, committed the misconduct. He was the one who lied. Not only did he never apologize for costing the taxpayers, the Justice Department, the Secret Service, his staff, his constituents, or anyone for putting them through the ringer, endangering our careers and our very lives. He wanted us to believe that he was sorry for embarrassing his family, Chelsea and Hillary. I can understand about Chelsea. In typical Billary fashion, they claimed they hadn't created the problem. The media had, the Republicans, the lawyers, anyone but them. He was sorry, he said. I couldn't stand it anymore. I grew angrier, got out of bed, and went out for a run. I just hoped the president was right. I hoped it was time to get back to work. but why should any of his lies be different from the others? August turned into September. Jenny and I were still living in the shitbox, a rundown rental home that sheltered us as we awaited the building of our new home. While driving there one day, I received a call from former UD colleague Sandy. "Burn," I said. Cops answer phones like cops even when they're home. "They effed us, Gary. They effed us." "Whoa, whoa, calm down. Who effed us? What are—" "I can't believe it. I can't believe it. Are you watching? They effed us, Gary. They released the G-damn tapes. Our depositions are playing on the damn television. We're all over the G-damn news. They're showing our faces." She kept repeating herself frantically and angrily. Get a call like that, and your mind races. Her voice resembled the intonation of a fellow officer calling for backup, one hand on the walkie-talkie, one on a drawn gun. Sandy sounded just like the canine officer who had called for backup when I'd hopped the barricade and raced across the park to assist her against that knife-wielding suspect. But Sandy's trouble, and mine, was on television screens nationwide, on every news channel. I raced home and told Jenny about it. A neighbor appeared at our door. "Hey, Gary." He saw my expression, my nervous attitude. I asked, "Everything okay?" "Something's going on. Do you have cable?" We didn't. He nodded. He led me down to his half-finished basement. His kids were watching cartoons and playing with race cars and Barbie dolls. I grabbed the remote and started flipping through channels. There was C-SPAN, and there I was on it. This was only the second time I had seen my video deposition. The first was during my testimony, when I'd been asked to confirm my testimony. But there I was on TV. I remember thinking, the Justice Department and the FBI did F us. My neighbor's kids stopped pleading for their cartoons and sat speechless. They looked at the TV, the man on it, and then back at me, back and forth. My neighbor was doing the same thing. He exclaimed, "Oh, Gary, you're so effed," and issued a nervous laugh. I was speechless. A Justice Department lawyer soon explained to me that his department technically hadn't lied. Nobody technically lies in this game, it seems. The department didn't release the tapes to the public, but it knew damn well that it was going to release all its evidence to Congress. And once Congress got its own hands on the evidence, it would release as much or as little of it as it pleased. Congress released our tapes and more than 3,000 pages of the Star investigation's findings. I wasn't out of the grinder yet. The media wasn't buzzing. It roared over every word. It was the ultimate game of he said, she said, and fell right on American party lines. The Republican third of the country hated the Clintons. Another third wasn't sure. The Democratic third vehemently towed the Clinton line. Folks in the middle waited for the smoke to clear, but kept lapping it all up. Nothing was more embarrassing for this nation than the release of the president's grand jury testimony. Starr's investigators asked him to corroborate, or contradict, the sworn, often protected by immunity testimony of Monica, presidential staff members, Secret Service agents, and UD officers like myself. But his lies, and his earlier actions, trapped him in a painful, steel-strong web. Not even his elaborate legal weaseling could free him. For hours on end, a weasel did what weasels do, but a man was nowhere to be found. For weeks and months, pundits debated its significance. They parsed the words and counted up the damage. The cost to President Clinton was incalculable. His character was laid bare. The questions were relevant, though embarrassing, and often, when you got down to it, obscene. News anchors prefaced accounts of the event by warning viewers that some of the language used was sexual, graphic, and vulgar, and that kids shouldn't watch. They kept saying it was not for children and explicit. The world was glued to their sets and salivating to the drama. The president swore to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help him God, he swore. They reminded him of his oath immediately after he took it, and reminded him of his responsibilities. They couldn't have made it any clearer, but the independent counsel had to, because it was now President Bill Clinton's testimony against himself and what he had sworn before, and the word of others, including myself. I wanted vindication, but I also wanted this to go away. All of the USSS was watching too, and they knew my part. Many were still pissed off. They asked the president if he'd been truthful before, and he said he had. He was obviously, awkwardly, and painfully weaseling through a series of lies. They moved on to Monica Lewinsky, asking if he had been physically intimate with her. If he had lied about her, and he had, they'd shake his credibility regarding the Paula Jones case, Whitewater, and just about anything else, really. The president got ahead of the line of questioning and asked to read from a prepared statement of his relationship with Miss Lewinsky. But right off the bat, he admitted that he had been alone with her on multiple occasions. One weight had been lifted from my shoulders and another had been placed on my chest. During this slow-motion train wreck, the president confirmed what I had said, that he had been alone with her, thereby contradicting his previous affidavit, the one he said was still somehow true. He then continued, saying he hadn't lied because he thought when asked about sexual relations, he interpreted that phrase as sexual intercourse, which he hadn't had. It was a huge stretch only a weasel with a law degree could make. If Monica Lewinsky says that you used a cigar as a sexual aid with her in the Oval Office area, would she be lying? Yes, no, or won't answer. I will revert to my former statement. Unbelievable. This is the man I was protecting? That's what I tolerated? I had tried and tried to prevent harm to this president, but he failed us all. He and investigators tangled over the definition of sexual regarding intercourse. President Clinton introduced an entire generation to the concept of oral sex, and worse, provided them with rationalizations for risky behavior. They asked him, "If Monica Lewinsky says that you had phone sex with her, would she be lying?" He responded, "Well, that is, at least in general terms, I think, is covered by my statement." The lawyer, getting frustrated, went on. "Let me define phone sex for purposes of my question. Phone sex occurs when the party to the phone conversation masturbates while the other party is talking in a sexually explicit manner. The question is, if Monica Lewinsky says that you had phone sex with her, would she be lying?" Jeez. That phone line was one of the reasons I had recommended to Evelyn Lieberman that Monica be transferred or moved, but I never knew what the hell she and the president did over that drop line. The president again responded, "I think that is covered by my statement." They followed that with a discussion of how the president ensured that Monica had an employment payback for her past services and maybe even for her future silence about the whole mess. The country would later gain more details of how the president had approached his friend, the influential Washington power broker Vernon Jordan, to assist Monica in securing private sector employment. Jordan, who served on the board of directors of Revlon Cosmetics, pulled strings to see that Monica got a look-see there. He did the same with another corporation on whose board he served. Jordan was the president's pal, but he was no dummy. He was nervous about assisting Monica when she had been subpoenaed in the Paula Jones case, and he even quizzed Clinton on whether he'd had sex with Monica. The investigator brought that up. Clinton pathetically continued to bob and weave, obfuscating and deflecting left and right. I heard them say, "Question. But isn't that why Vernon Jordan asked you on December 19th whether or not you had sexual relationships with Monica Lewinsky, and why he asked her? Because he knew it would be so highly improper to be helping her with a lawyer and a job if, in fact, she had had a relationship with you?" Clinton, "I don't know. I don't believe that at all. I don't believe that at all, particularly since, even if you look at the facts here in their light most unfavorable to me, no one has suggested that there was any sexual harassment on my part. And I don't think it was wrong to be helping her." They went on to discuss gifts exchanged between Monica and the president, gifts swapped with Betty Curry as a conduit, gifts I knew of and was extremely wary about. He finessed his way through it all, playing the I don't recall game. He played the same game when asked about how Betty and UD officers had inserted Betty's name on their official visitors log when it was Monica who actually visited, so as not to betray the president. It was yet another obvious lie on his part. I knew that game. Everyone with eyes could see it. He never recalled how she came to him with letters or papers. There was a back and forth on how the Clintons had garnered a lawyer for Monica so she could obfuscate matters and not implicate the president in his defense in Paula Jones's civil sexual harassment case. They discussed how unethical that was, and that's when the president had the nerve to blame the debacle on the information's getting leaked, not that it actually happened. Finally, it came down to blaming Monica. The president was on a roll, employing the most time-tested tactic from the Clinton machine playbook. After I terminated the improper contact with her, she wanted to come in more than she did. She got angry when she didn't get in sometimes. I knew that that might make her more likely to speak to Paula Jones' lawyers, and I still did it because I had to limit the contact. And thirdly, let me say, I formed an opinion really in early 1996, and again, well, let me finish the sentence. I formed an opinion early in 1996, once I got into this unfortunate and wrong conduct, that when I stopped it, which I knew I'd have to do, and which I should have done a long time before I did, that she would talk about it. Not because Monica Lewinsky is a bad person. She's basically a good girl. She's a good young woman with a good heart and a good mind. I think she is burdened by some unfortunate conditions of her upbringing. But she's basically a good person. But I knew the minute there was no longer any contact, she would talk about this. She would have to. She couldn't help it. It was a part of her psyche. So I had put myself at risk, sir. I was not trying to buy her silence. I thought she was a good person. She had not been involved with me for a long time in any improper way, several months, and I wanted to help her get on with her life. It's just as simple as that. It's time for a break, said his obviously frustrated interrogator. The break failed to improve his memory. You had to wonder, if the man wasn't president, how would he find his car keys in the morning? Or maybe, as Nebraska Senator Bob Kerry, a Democrat, once observed of him, he was just an unusually good liar. Unusually good. The note about how Monica missed him that was in the book she gave him for Christmas, can't recall. The conversations regarding her signing the affidavit, can't remember. His conversations with Betty Curry, ditto. Weasel. He had no right to embarrass someone as dedicated to the country as Curry. He had no right to do this to me or the rest of us. The deposition continued. They literally couldn't agree on a definition of alone, as if his statements were just a form of miscommunication. Hey, there were other people on planet Earth last night, so maybe I wasn't alone with my wife. It got worse, playing out on national television for all the world to see and devise its own judgments about. An attorney discussed with the president the semen on Monica's dress and how he would touch her, arouse her, and gratify her. The testimony grew even more contentious. I wanted to switch it off. I couldn't. My head ached from all my head shaking. On the screen before me, they continued jousting regarding a conversation between the president and Betty that he told to jog his own memory, not to coach Betty, a potential witness, on what to say. They discussed the president's statement and the line of questioning's scope, and how the investigation's intention was not to embarrass the president and the office, but only to ask questions that pertained to his credibility and his perjury, and certainly not to delve into private details that would be kept for all of history and possibly released publicly. That's when the president really pissed me off by saying, "And so, I think I am right to answer all the questions about perjury, but not to say things which will be forever in the annals of the United States because of this unprecedented videotape and may be leaked at any time. I just think it's a mistake. And so I'm doing my best to cooperate with the grand jury and still protect myself, my family, and my office." It was far too little, too late. They asked him, Well, the grand jury would like to know, Mr. President, why it is that you think that oral sex performed on you does not fall within the definition of sexual relations as used in this deposition. The weasel responded in a sweaty yet matter-of-fact way, because that is, if the deponent is the person who has oral sex performed on him, then the contact is with, not with anything on that list, but with the lips of another person. It seems to be self-evident that that's what it is. And I thought it was curious. Let me remind you, sir, I read this carefully, and I thought about it. I thought about what contact meant. I thought about what intent to arouse or gratify meant. And I had to admit, under this definition, that I'd actually had sexual relations with Jennifer Flowers. Now, I would rather have taken a whipping than done that, after all the trouble I'd been through with Jennifer Flowers, and the money I knew that she made for the story she told about this alleged 12-year affair, which we had done a great deal to disprove. So I didn't like any of this, but I had done my best to deal with it, and that's what I thought. And I think that's what most people would think, reading that. What the hell does that even mean? Only the most lawyerly of weasels, or the most weaselly of lawyers, could concoct something so insane. This was our president. Still, the suffering continued. Each awkward minute of this embarrassing back and forth mattered deeply to me. How hard we trained, how particularly we UD agents were selected to be worthy of trust and confidence, was completely thrown away in his service. Then things really got heated. The president tried employing his classic charm, but now it seemed more like venom than honey. Shifting sideways and forward and back, he two-stepped around each word and its definable wiggle room to lie some more, creating as much doubt as anyone might dare. Well, you're not telling our grand jurors that you think the case was a political case for setup, Mr. President? That would give you the right to commit perjury? The lawyer asked. No, sir. No, sir. In the face of the Joneses' lawyers, the people that were questioning me, in the face of their illegal leaks, their constant unrelenting illegal leaks, in a lawsuit that I knew, and that by the time that this deposition and this discovery started, they knew, was a bogus suit on the law and bogus suit on the facts. He went on, in the face of that, I know that in the face of their illegal activity, I still had to behave lawfully. But I wanted to be legal without being particularly helpful. I thought that was what I was trying to do. And this is you're the first person to ever suggest to me that I should have been doing their lawyer's work for them when they were perfectly free to ask follow-up questions. On one or two occasions, Mr. Clinton lawyer Bob Bennett invited them to ask follow-up questions. It now appears to me they didn't because they were afraid I would give them a truthful answer, and that they had been in some communication between you and Ms. Tripp and them. And they were trying to set me up and trick me. And now you seem to be complaining that they didn't do a good enough job. I did my best, sir, at this time. I did not know what I now know about this. A lot of other things were going on in my life. Did I want this to come out? No. Was I embarrassed about it? Yes. Did I ask her to lie about it? No. Did I believe there could be a truthful affidavit? Absolutely. Again, he was caught in another lie of his own making. I wondered if this was how I looked when I gave my statement. But then again, I knew how I looked. I saw it on C-SPAN. I didn't weasel. I followed the rules that had been laid out for me by the Secret Service, the Justice Department, and my lawyers. It was simple. I didn't weasel. Until Chief Justice Rehnquist gave me permission, I followed the rules that had been laid out for me by the Secret Service, the Justice Department, and my lawyers. It was why I had to preface so much without revealing any privileged information on the advice of my counsel. But the president admitted that he lied only to save face. Investigators caught him on it. You're not going back on your earlier statement that you understood you were sworn to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to the folks at that deposition, are you, Mr. President? The lawyer asked. I remember thinking, don't help him. Don't feed his statements. Cut him down. The president went on treading his own legal minefield as if he forgot where he placed the mines. He babbled on about how he deplored how Ken Starr and Paula Jones's lawyers, funded by his political enemies, were trying to gather intel and then illegally leak it against him, In reality, it was Linda Tripp, his own former White House employee, who despised him for who he really was, who trapped him. It was Monica, his cohort, his mistress, who couldn't keep her mouth shut and made Tripp's involvement possible. How was this president so different from Richard Nixon when Nixon arrogantly claimed, "I'm saying when the president does something, it's not illegal"? I watched Clinton continue. "So I will admit this, sir. My goal in this deposition was to be truthful, but not particularly helpful." Oaths such as "the whole truth" and "nothing but the truth, so help me God," it was clear to me, meant as much as "shall not be infringed" or "swear to uphold and defend," among others. For men of character, life is very simple. It's best to keep it that way. But clearly for the guy I was watching on television, life was just a sharp answer to woo a voter. Bill Clinton thought he had all the answers, but he never even understood the real questions in life. I watched the rest of his proceedings in pieces, not being able to stand the deposition for more than a few minutes at a time. It was an embarrassment to me and the nation. Later, I watched it again, and that time I noticed how they discussed the witness list in the Paula Jones case, and when the president had seen Monica's name on it. This was part of the story I hadn't known about. I wasn't privy to such things. That was December 6, 1997. And it was a date I knew very well, but not because of Paula Jones, but because that was the day Betty Curry stalled Monica at the Northwest Gate. Ken Starr's investigator continued. Now, on the morning of the 6th of December, Monica Lewinsky came to the Northwest Gate and found that you were being visited by Eleanor Mondale at the same time and had an extremely angry reaction. You know that, sir, don't you? Holy shit. He was screwing with Eleanor in the Oval Office on that same day. The same day that the witness list for Paula Jones came out. You couldn't write this shit, I've always said, because these people were frankly so g-damn unprofessional. Clinton responded flatly, "I know that." But underneath his cool demeanor, I saw he was seething. Bottom line, he couldn't keep his mistresses, where he saw them, and how he communicated with them, straight. I burst out laughing. He continued, "What I remember is that Monica was very upset. She got upset from time to time, and I was, you know, I couldn't see her. I had some other work to do that morning." Another complete lie. The gall. He was seeing Eleanor, the B-list media star. I'd surprised them in the map room and had testified about it. I also testified to corroborate another Northwest Gate officer's testimony of what he told Monica when she just arrived, completely off schedule and off book, to the White House to see the president spontaneously, as if that's how things were. But then again, I knew that's how things were done. Unbelievable. But it was right there on C-SPAN. I'd seen his character firsthand. President Clinton saying he had work to do December 6 when he was seeing Eleanor Mondale. It was too elaborate a maze to navigate. "And she had just sort of showed up and wanted to be let in and wanted to come in at a certain time. And she wanted everything to be that way. And we couldn't see her. Now, I did arrange to see her later that day, and I was upset about her conduct." He was upset about her conduct? What about his conduct? "I'm not sure I knew or focused on, at that moment, exactly the question you asked. I thought her conduct was inappropriate that day." It kept getting worse. Off camera, you could hear in the lawyer's voice that their nostrils were filled with the scent of blood. It must have been intoxicating. After all, this was the ultimate "a few good men" moment they lived for. The president continued, "I don't know whether I found out that day. I knew that somehow she knew that that Eleanor Mondale was in to see us that day. I don't know that I knew how she knew that on that day. I don't remember that." Pardon me. That leads into my second question, which is, weren't you irate at the Secret Service precisely because they had revealed this information to Miss Lewinsky on that very day? So irate that you told several people, or at least one person, that somebody should be fired over this on that very day? This was also absolutely true, and he absolutely demanded it, with a heavy-handed insinuation, to forget it ever happened. It was no different from the time I had turned Monica away at the Oval Office in trying to protect the presidency, and frankly, the Clinton brand. The president had immediately leaned out the door, stared me right in the face as I stood next to the PPD agent, and said he was expecting someone to come with papers, and that if I saw them, to let them in. For all the Clintons' repeated scandals, they blamed everybody except themselves. Every time I heard the Clintons blame the vast right-wing conspiracy, the uniformed division, the agents on their personal details, their staff persons, the media, and others, I realized how glad I was to have gotten out of their White House when I did. I got out too late, but still mostly unscathed. I could still provide for my family, and by God's graces and a few men of real character, I remained on the job and became an instructor. That semen-stained blue dress saved our lives, one way or the other, in the media or from the Clinton machine's ire. I watched as the president continued to bash the Secret Service and the uniformed division on how inappropriate it was to reveal whom the president met with. Yes, we had, but he was so wildly beyond protocol and sowing discord among us for so long that he had no business judging an officer's character when his own mistress showed up to the White House for her booty call. The machine pushed me out. It pissed off Tripp, it pissed off the Fox, and it jeopardized the character and integrity of the presidency in so many ways. The Clintons never had our backs. They were on it. He demeaningly referred to us as these uniform people. I witnessed a funny little moment when the lawyer caught the president in a bind. He ended his question about the president's insinuating or directly telling officers and Betty Curry to make sure the Monica becoming irate story didn't get told out of school. And he ended his question with, "Or anything to that effect?" The president snapped, "What does that mean, anything to that effect?" "Well, Mr. President, you've told us that you are not going to try to help the Joneses' attorneys, and I think it's clear from your testimony that you were pretty literal at times. So that's what I'm saying. I don't necessarily know the exact words. The question was, do you have any knowledge of the fact?" I enjoyed watching the man who still inhabited the Oval Office squirm. He looked as I did when I was trying to protect him in my own grand jury testimony. Minutes went by, and when I was done rubbing my eyes, my face and mouth muscles were tight from laughing, gritting, and fighting tears of despair. His supporters had so much hope for this candidate and president. He promised so much. "Well, I have a question regarding your definition. And my question is oral sex performed on you within that definition as you understood it?" "As I understood it, it was not, no," said the weasel. When asked about the semen stain, he couldn't even give a straight answer. Congress moved toward his impeachment, exactly what I had tried to save him from. Impeachment proceeded. It was hell, but I wanted it all to go away. Either shit or get off the damn pot. Impeach him or don't, but I wanted it off the papers, and my face off C-SPAN and all the other cable news networks. I wanted Bill off the news, too. As long as he was on TV, I knew no work was getting done at the White House. And the impeachment proceedings damn near shut down, if not locked down, both the House of Representatives and the Senate. Two Republican speakers of the House forfeited their jobs after their own infidelities came to light. Unbelievable. But at least they had the decency to step aside. The president was impeached on grounds of perjury before the grand jury and obstructing justice, which were both so demonstratively true. A count involving perjury in the Paula Jones case and an abuse of power charge failed. Were his misdeeds sufficient reason to strip him from office? He'd perjured himself, ruined his own reputation, tarnished the presidency, and damaged, if not destroyed, the careers, reputations, and lives of a great many people, from myself to Monica to many of his staff. And for what? The Paula Jones case wasn't a scam. President Clinton and his attorney, Bob Bennett, filed for dismissal but her suit wasn't dismissed. It was real enough for Bill Clinton to fork over $850,000 in November 1998 to settle it. He admitted no wrongdoing. That's not his style. But he paid and got back to work. In February 1999, the Senate acquitted President Clinton on both the perjury and obstruction of justice charges. He'd long been a lame duck. Now, so was Congress. President Clinton had squandered every chance of getting real work done for his own constituents and supporters. The Clintons didn't lose, but certainly no one won. I hoped it was all over, but I'd been disappointed before.